And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Thomas Razzetto, back with us. He was with our dear colleague, Richard Serrett, about a year ago. Joins us. His book is called Living the Paradox of Enlightenment. We'll talk about spiritual awakening next on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you. Thomas Razzetto is one of the freshest voices offering guidance on enlightenment and spiritual awakening. He expresses his ideas in very simple, clear English, and this makes it really easy for people to understand these very deep subjects. Thomas has taught a class for the Center for Lifelong Learning through the Santa Barbara City College about his book, Living the Paradox of Enlightenment. And back in 2012, he spoke for the prestigious lecture series Mind and Supermind, which is run by the Santa Barbara City College. Thomas also talks about conscious creation in a way that, well, might be helpful for many people. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, George. Thank you so much for having me on.
Our mutual friend, Mr. Serrett, Richard Serrett, highly recommended you to us.
Oh, really? That's good to hear.
Yeah.
He's such a good guy. We met over the air about, gosh, I think it was 2008, because that's when we first started talking about the Houdini experiment,
the afterlife experiment,
which actually I wrote for your attention.
That's right.
Here we are.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And tell us a little bit more about yourself, other than the bio, if you would.
Oh, you know, I grew up here in L.A., grade school, high school, headed off to college in Santa Barbara, spent about 45 years in Santa Barbara. And last Thanksgiving, my mom asked me to move in with her. She hadn't lived alone in a while, and, you know, my father passed away in 2012. Mm. So I thought that was a good thing. So good for her and good for me. So I moved in here. It's quite an adjustment for me. I'm a small town kind of guy, but here I am in Los Angeles. And during all that time, I really worked on science and math, and I was a long distance runner, reasonably successful in that, in the sense that I was on the team at UC Santa Barbara, and that was really fun. And I just enjoyed being up there and hiking up in the hills and playing volleyball and making good friends. And
good for you.
It was really good.
Good for you. And you know what? Good for you helping your mother. That's
oh, thanks
important.
For that.
My father went in 2011, and my first sister, one of two, I had one that passed also. My mother asked her to move in with her just so she could help out around the house and stuff like that. And
and to be honest, she's the one who's helping me, you know. She's putting the roof over the head and the food on the table. I do what I can, you know, but she's just a champion, superstar, a wonderful person. So I can't say enough about my mom.
It's funny that we move away, but we never really move away, do we?
Yeah, that's true.
Tell us about the book, Living the Paradox of Enlightenment.
You know, in around 2005, I started to go to a teacher in Santa Barbara. It was a small group that met every week. And when I first went, it wasn't like, wow, this is incredible. It was just like, huh, this is interesting. I think I'll go some more. And I just kept going and going. And then pretty soon I said, you know, I'm always going to go. I'm going to go every week. I went for 11 years. And during that time, I developed more and more essays. I just started writing more and more essays for my website. I actually started writing essays for my website in like 20 years ago. But now they kicked up to a new level. And so these essays got integrated into the book and refined, and so that's how the book came about.
And there's lots of things to talk about with you tonight, Thomas, about enlightenment and spiritual awakening. I want your take on how you think the world is headed today, because there's something missing. I just can't put my finger on it, but people seem to be upset, uptight. It's just has a different feel to it. Are you picking that up too?
Oh, I think so. I'm not as connected to the main public like you might be, but I still think I pick it up more like an intuitive or a psychic way, you know? And there's an anxiousness, you know, which is a low-level type of fear. It's anxiety when you can't see the lion that's chasing you. You think there's a problem, but you don't really know what it is and what to do about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's absolutely
and so,
true.
What I would like to point out is it could be like a chick inside an egg, you know, and you're the food is there and you're absorbing the food and, you know, there's getting less and less food and you're getting a little bit anxious because it looks like you're going to run out of food and, oh my gosh, that's going to be the end of you. But you don't realize the changes that are taking place within you, and you're getting a bigger body and a stronger body. And now you're going to break out of that eggshell and you're going to be into a whole new world full of other little chicks and sunshine and things. So there's no real way of saying what's going to come.
Now, the word enlightenment, what does that mean to you?
You know, I have a definition that I use, and many people would point out that there is no strict definition, but this is the definition that I use. And we're going to start, I have 2 points that make this up, and we're going to start with the second point because it's a little bit easier for us to get our handle on that.
Okay.
Being completely free from all selfish or self-centered desires and tendencies. So with that, I'm just basically saying being a good person, being a kind person, being a compassionate person. So there's no real, oh, wow, that's profound. I mean, no, I've never heard that before. That isn't going to happen when I say that. But it's really interesting that some people have definitions of enlightenment that leave that out completely. And it just doesn't make any sense to me to have someone be considered enlightened when they're not a good person, a kind person. So that's an important point. And then the first point goes to a deeper truth that might be a little hard to get to right here at the beginning of the interview without laying some foundation, but I'll put it on the table anyway. It's being fully awake to the intuitive understanding of your true self as the one divine source awareness, the one self that arises as all apparent selves. Now, that is probably a very mysterious statement, so we might have to dig into that as the night goes on.
Are you finding that people are trying to become a little more enlightened?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. They sometimes have an urgency about it, which, you know, you can't go about this and be urgent about it. You have to relax into it and let it grow naturally. But it can really help if you have a little bit of guidance. And like I said, I started to go to my mentor in 2005, and I just continued to go to those meetings. And it was so interesting to see him be an example and his relaxed nature, and he's at peace and he's available for kindness and compassion. And so that was inspiring to me, but he was also very helpful in understanding some of these deeper truths about who you really are.
Who are we anyways, Thomas? That's
well, you
the
know,
big
this
question.
Takes us to one of the points that you bring up on the show many times, and that has to do with this this saying that you've heard. It goes something like this. You are not a human being having a spiritual experience, but instead you are a spiritual being having a human experience. You've heard that before, of course.
I sure have.
Yeah, and this is what I consider the first key spiritual awakening. And to rephrase it, you have a soul. So before that, you might think, I'm just a body. I'm cruising around. Something happens to the body. I die. You know, that's the end of me. Boom. That's the end of you. That's your definition of who you are, the body. That's a materialist definition of who you are. Well, people like yourself, George, I heard you talking the other night about your own out-of-body experience.
11 years old. I haven't been able to duplicate it, but I sure had one.
How old was it?
11.
11, okay. So the fact that you had it shows you without a doubt that this materialist definition of who you are is at least incomplete. You know, there's more to you than that. And so I read lots of books about out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences and conscious memory of past lives. And through this, I gained both an intellectual understanding to some extent, and I realized that that's a limited understanding because it's only intellectual, but I also had an intuitive understanding. And then there's the experiential understanding that you were able to tap into that I have not yet tapped into that. But all of that points to this truth, this key spiritual understanding that you have a soul. Now, the soul is involved in the creation of the body, and throughout its entire life, the body and the soul are interacting, you know, tied together. And then at the very end of physical life, the soul drops off. I mean, I'm sorry, the soul drops the body, and the body just, that's the end of that. So
And does it all over again,
Yes, yeah, and that shows us that the body is not essential to the soul. And then when this awareness, this awakening happens, a lot of people think that this is who they are, that they must fundamentally be a soul. And what I'm suggesting is that we're now going to dig even deeper than that. We're going to step back from the soul. And at that point, the mystic finds out that they exist fundamentally as the power of sentience. They exist as this open capacity for experience. And if I may put this in another set of words, you know you exist, and you know you are sentient. And what I'm saying is that you exist fundamentally as this power of sentience. When you strip away everything that's not essential to what you are, you end up with this power of sentience, which is not a thing. You are not a thing that is sentient. You are not an object that is aware. You are not a sentient being. You are sentience itself. And this is the second key awakening.
When you were teaching your class at the Center for Lifelong Learning, what did these students want to learn? What were they there for?
I would say that they really wanted to relieve their suffering. So they wanted to find out why things that they didn't want, difficult challenges kept arising for them. And it's kind of, you want to both have relief to that, and if you can, prevent these things from arising in the first place. Learning how to work with them and be a little bit more emotionally accepting of your challenges. And then maybe changing some of your core beliefs in a way where these challenges may not arise so sharply. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, but when they leave the class, how do they leave it? Are they upbeat? Are they puzzled?
Oh,
how do they leave it?
Well, I would say that I didn't have a lot of students on a regular basis, so we were able to deal kind of one-on-one as a, you know, small class allows. So they were able to kind of tune into what I was saying and open up to it. I'll put it this way. That class was a couple weeks long. I forget how long it was.
Yeah.
But even when I heard these ideas, I had to go and think about them for months. And some of them I had been dealing with for years. So this has matured in me for a long period of time. So I hope some of that experience that I've gone through will help me put it on the table a little clearer so people can get to the core of what it might be that they might utilize more successfully.
Thomas, can you teach kindness, or is that within you?
You know, it really does come from within.
That's what
But sometimes you can inspire it. Either by example, it's hard to teach kindness in words in front of a chalkboard, but sometimes I can put something on the table where someone will go, oh, I can see where this other person that I'm having conflict with is actually, they also are this manifestation of this divine essence. They themselves are thoroughly divine. And I'm going to respect them for that, even though we've been clashing horns. So maybe there's a little lessening of that tension.
What would happen if a nation practiced this as we would as individuals, and instead of being an aggressor or attacking other nations or warring countries, became a nation of kindness and helped other countries out of whatever dilemmas they might have had, whether it's food shortages or whatever, but became a country of being benevolent and kind? What do you think would happen?
Well, it would be a world transformation if both the leaders and the citizens of that country were joyfully participating in that. And you'll know that you, and I like the fact that you put that on such a large scale. And I was talking to a friend of mine from high school who I hadn't seen in many, many years. I talked to him recently at a wedding, and he said he was working with people that were having trouble just making a living and stuff like that. And you know, they were trying to help them in these ways. And the point that it's so difficult to make people realize is that you need to change your core beliefs. We're so focused on action. We're going to change our actions. Well, the actions and the core beliefs and the emotions are the three components of conscious creation. And if you don't change the seed, the core seed, the world is a safe place. How could you believe that as a core belief? That's so profoundly different from the idea the world is a dangerous place and I need protection. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. You wrote an essay about Tookie Williams. Would that be the gangster from L.A. by any chance?
Yes, yes, it is. And
Stanley Tookie Williams, right?
Stanley Tookie Williams. He was 12 years old when he got involved in the Crips. In fact, he was one of the founding members.
He got executed eventually, didn't he?
In 2000.
Lethal injection, I think.
I think it was 2005, the same year.
While they still had the death penalty.
Exactly. And yeah. He was writing these short little children's books. He had a co-author, and he wrote many of them, and they were inspiring children. He was showing them the false promise of gang life. And lots of children were sending him letters telling him that he was the reason that they stayed out of gangs. And I would have thought the state of California would put him on the lecture tour. You know, if he's doing
well, they executed him instead, right?
They executed him instead. And when that happened, I was crushed. I was just, and I didn't expect to have such a strong emotional reaction. But I had gone to sleep that night, and I knew that the execution was scheduled for midnight. And I had gone to sleep at around 11, and I woke up around a couple minutes before 1. And I knew if I pushed that button on my clock radio, there would be the news coming up at the top of the hour. And sure enough, they said he was executed. And I just broke down crying.
He was convicted of murder, right? Four counts, I think, something like that.
Yeah, I don't know how many counts it was. And he did say he was framed, but I'll tell you one thing. As the head of that gang, there was plenty of, shall we say, dark deeds done over many decades.
Absolutely.
You know,
the Crips, right?
Yeah, the Crips. One of the Crips and the Bloods were two of the main LA gangs. So, anyway, the fact that he was taken away from his family, now he was in prison. I mean, there was a petition to prevent the execution. It wasn't a petition to release him, but that petition was not honored and he was executed and I was just crushed. But when I was crushed, as I felt that tremendous sadness within me, I said, I stepped back from it a little bit and I said, I'm going to pull this sadness right into me and I'm going to find out what it really is. Because you could have someone tell you about their sadness or you could try to tell someone about yours, but when it's right there, full emotion, full strength, that's the time to really learn what it is. So as I pulled it in, it just dissolved. My body was still crying, but it just dissolved. And so what I realized is that I could sit in that place of a little more comfort, stepping back from that, a place of what I call divine bliss, where I accept the fact that my body is crying and I'm experiencing this very sharp emotional sadness. And I make an analogy of being like a mother holding her crying child. And you can be like both of them. And she can be in bliss while she holds her child because she loves her child so much. She would never reject her child, even though her child at that time is crying.
Thomas Rosetto with us. His book is called Living the Paradox of Enlightenment. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We will take calls with Thomas next hour. I want to talk with him about consciousness when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send out little notes all the time, and then email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. George Norrie back with you, along with Thomas Rosetto, as we talk about his work, Living the Paradox of Enlightenment. Thomas, let's talk a little bit about consciousness. Give me your definition of what that is.
Let's go with the easy one.
All right. With the hard one, too.
Well, we'll start easy, and maybe we'll work up to something a little more difficult. Imagine a room with 10 people in it. Obviously, there are 10 physical bodies. I'd like to say that there's also 10 souls. Now, another phrase for soul is personal consciousness, the consciousness of the person. So we now have 10 bodies and 10 souls, 10 bodies and 10 personal consciousnesses. But earlier I was saying that this power of sentience is just one reality. sharing these bodies and souls. So real quickly, let's use an analogy of an actor. We know that a regular actor takes the role of one character at a time. What I'm saying is that this invisible reality, this God, this source awareness, is arising simultaneously as everyone's soul and everyone's body, and then looking through their eyes and listening through their ears. So their body and their soul are like windows. A window can't see anything. A window has no sentience of its own. So the body has no sentience of its own, but it's a window into the physical world. And the personal consciousness, the soul of the person, is like another window. And when it lines up with the physical body in normal states of consciousness, like we are in right now, this one awareness looks through these two windows and has an experience of that person. Am I making any sense? Should I work with that a little bit?
Let's work with that a little bit.
Sure. So your consciousness is in itself not really sentient, but you yourself are not fundamentally your soul. You yourself are behind that soul. You yourself is this power of sentience, this open capacity for experience, this one awareness. This is what you are. This is, it's not a thing that is sentient. It is the sentience itself. So it is not a thing that is alive. It is aliveness itself. This is what you are, and this is why you feel alive. And yet when this reality, this source awareness, looks through the personal consciousness and the body, there is an experience that puts in the mind of the person. Since the person cannot see this source awareness, it puts into its mind, I am a separate, mortal, sentient being, because that's what it looks like.
Thomas, are we the soul, or is the soul us?
You exist in a more fundamental way that arises as not only the soul and not only the body, but this source awareness is the source of the totality of created reality. Everything arises from this source. And this source awareness, is the only thing that witnesses it. And yet it constructs these viewpoints, these bodies and souls working together, to look into all of this created reality, all the mountains and streams and the other people running around and doing things. So the view through each person is of all the other persons and all the other things. So this one awareness is actually multitasking in a phenomenal way, so that all these persons, which appear to be separate mortal sentient beings, are actually an expression and an extension of this one awareness. So you are both the source and you are everything that's created. It's like the actor and the character. The actor is coming forth as the character, but the character is not fundamentally who the actor really is. The actor is fundamentally just the actor, as far as the metaphor goes. And so the actor can drop the role of the character. It doesn't depend on the creation of the character, just like God doesn't really depend upon creation, yet all of creation depends upon God.
Where does intuition, telepathy, clairvoyance come from?
It all comes from God, but it's playing into the soul. And then the physical mind is also sometimes tuning into it or picking up on it, like an idea being handed off from that deeper intuitive space into the conscious mind, where you can now vocalize it like, oh, you know, I'm going to consider this idea that my fundamental self is not the soul. I'm going to consider this fundamental idea that I exist as pure awareness. I'm going to hold that for a while. And there may be some intuitive awareness, intuitive recognition of that, and it might grow deeper. All of these awakenings take place over a long period of time. Some people think that they're very quick. And in some sense, you can say that they're quick, but there's always this sense of deepening, which can take not only years, but sometimes lifetimes.
Do you believe that positive thinking gets things done?
Definitely. Positive thinking is very important. And if you don't use your outer circumstances as a measure, you can use it as a goal, but you shouldn't use it as a measure. What you should be measuring is your inner emotional state of being, one of joy, one of celebration. And this will bring around actions that are aligned to this joy, whatever it is you're inspired to do. And as long as your inspirations are not selfish, it can be very helpful. And in this regard, I'd like to bring up that children's book. Everyone's heard it, The Little Engine That Could. You remember that?
Chug, chug, chug.
Yeah, The Little Engine That Could. What was the motivation? What was it?
I think I can.
Exactly. Right? And the motivation was what? Was it a selfish motivation? No. The little engine was trying to bring presence to the children on the other side of the mountain. So it's motivated to do good, to make the world a better place. And in doing this, is it going, I know I can, I know I can, and pounding its fist on the table? No, it was engaging in a positive way, saying, I don't know what's really going to happen. No one does. But I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. And what's interesting to me is that was the way it was in the book. But there were two movies that were made, and they took a little bit of a change to that, and they made it, you can do anything you want. Now, that's a whole different kettle of fish, in my opinion. I do not believe that you can do and have whatever you want. What I think is best is that you not be afraid to try what you're inspired to do. And when someone says you can't do it, don't listen to them. But we don't really know what you can do. So be inspired, follow this inspiration, be joyful about it, and take action. Those three things, the belief that you are a worthy person, the emotions that flow from that, that enthusiasm, that joy, that kindness, and then the actions that flow out of that. Those are the three components of the creative process.
What did you think of the author Napoleon Hill?
You know,
Think and Grow Rich, I think was his
book. You had a fabulous guest on the other week, wasn't it? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to that, and there were some wonderful points that were made. And I think that's, none of them come to my mind right away, but everything that was brought up was quite interesting. And yes, these ideas are very important. And it was, you know, sometimes a book is put on into the marketplace with a title that the author might not have picked, right? The publisher might pick a title, this will sell more books, you know. And I think that was published pretty far back. Wasn't the Depression, in the time frame of the Depression?
I think so.
So, you know, you've got a lot of people are going to resonate with that title, Think and Grow Rich. And it's Think and Grow Joyful. And
1937.
Yeah, yeah. Think and grow joyful. And in that joyful action, know that God takes care of you. You may not be the richest man in the world, but you will be taken care of in any way that's appropriate for you. If you need something, it will be there. That's another thing. If you believe that there can be some scarcity and there can be a situation that arises that you do not have the resources to meet, then that will create a certain amount of uneasiness, fear, stress. But if you say, I don't know what I need, and I don't know what I need to do, but whatever it is, God will give me what's necessary. And if I just don't have it, well, that means I just don't need to do that thing at that time. So I think there's some really good points, but perhaps thinking on the outer condition of being wealthy might not be the best primary focus, but it's important to focus on that positive attitude. Yes.
Do you think with just about anything, whether it's a job, a relationship, anything, that you must visualize it and think about it first?
Not necessarily, because sometimes what's going to come to you is outside of the scope of what you might have imagined. But the important thing is to think, I am going to be loved. I am going to be taken care of as far as relationships and jobs go. And so there's only so much that you as a person can do. There's only so much that I as a person can do physically. My mind has limits. My body has limits. But when we talk about limits, I like to talk about a ukulele. And one time I was visiting my parents and we were watching public television and there was a musician on and he was talking about his ukulele and he was a virtuoso. And he talked on and on about the limitations of his ukulele. He said, it's so small. It doesn't play very loud. It only has a few strings. It doesn't play a very wide range of instruments. It's very limited. And he said, I fell in love with my ukulele because of those limitations. And when they played, you could hear that love affair come alive. And then think about this paradox. How many songs can be played on the ukulele? An infinite number of songs.
Endless. Now, let me ask you this. You have said that bad things happen to good people. I've always thought good things happen to good people. What's the song?
That's true. I really stated that more like a question, you know, because people often ask it that way. Why do bad things happen to good people? And again, sometimes...
Rotten luck.
Sometimes it is rotten luck, but sometimes these good people still have a core belief that they aren't deserving. And this brings us to one of the core beliefs that Seth, as channeled by Jane Roberts, puts on the table. Seth likes to say, the primary belief is, I am a worthy and deserving person. And so when you hold that, there's a much more likelihood that there will be things easier coming your way. It does not necessarily mean your body will be healed. You can take someone like Helen Keller, who was sighted at birth, but later lost her sight and also her hearing, right? And so she went on to inspire people in a way that couldn't have been done if it was another way, you know, if she had a normal, healthy life. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, she made it work for herself.
Exactly. And if you look for something good in everything, and that's also the story that was put on the table with Pollyanna, you know, look for the good in something. And play, as Pollyanna called it, the glad game. Find something to be glad about in everything. So some people, they have a lot of trouble being happy because they feel locked into a job that brings no satisfaction. They don't have many friends or whatever. And so they just focus on everything they don't have. Well, if you look around for something, you know, you're healthy or whatever it is, find something. And this is a conditional happiness. You're finding something and saying, I am going to be happy because of that condition. And then later, as you get better and better at it, you start to realize, I don't even need to find a condition. I can just choose to be happy now. And this is also one of the spiritual awakenings, that all of the outer conditions have absolutely no control over your inner emotional experience, your inner emotions.
So what do you think the soul is, Thomas?
The soul is a very important component of your human expression, of your human experience. And what's interesting is that Bashar talks about this when we talk about this idea of how much free will do we really have? Can we do anything? Bashar likes to point out that your soul chooses a theme for your life. And Seth also has a very similar set of explanations. Your soul is choosing a theme for your life, but it's chosen in a general way. So you may have a modest life or you may have a princely life. So your soul is very important in choosing like your parents and the circumstances that you're born into. And your soul is continually growing and dynamically being polished up. It's your soul that's being purified, your soul and your mind. Your mind is being purified of false ideas, and your heart and your soul are being purified. Selfishness is being washed away. But as your soul chooses this larger theme that you're going to be expressing in, your physical mind or, you know, your personal mind is choosing how to express yourself with its free will in your life in the moment. So the soul and the mind and the body, they all work together, and it's all this expression of this one awareness.
What's the most important? Is the mind more important than the soul?
You know, I talk about that a little bit. I actually use the word heart and mind, mm-hmm. but we could use soul. And I point out, some people say that there's conflict or they feel a conflict. But when you really wake up to the purpose of the two, when you purify the mind and you purify the heart, you realize that there isn't any tension between them, that they each have different jobs. and they're like two different hands, and they work together, and one hand washes the other, and together they both come clean. The mind gives up all the false ideas. I am not good enough to be loved. No one loves me. The world is a dangerous place. I need to protect myself. All those ideas are washed away. And the soul doesn't have to protect itself. A heart doesn't have to protect itself. It says, I can love. I don't need a shield. I can love. And as that happens, these two tools start to work together so that the person can share the one love of God with everyone.
Thomas Razzetto with us. We're going to take calls with Thomas next hour here on Coast to Coast. Thomas, give out your website, would you, sir?
InfinitelyMystical.com. Lots of free essays there.
Easy to remember. And we've got it linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. And where can people get Living the Paradox of Enlightenment?
The website's the best place to start. You'll see a link right there to Amazon, ebook and paperback.
And what are you working on next?
You know, I'm just working on some more essays, and I got a class that I'm offering. I'm in the L.A. area, so not that the class is an online class, so people all around the world can take it. But if there's enough interest in the Los Angeles area, I'm open to the idea of getting a class together where we can get together in person. I like that.
That's cool. Okay, stay with us, Thomas. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take some questions for you as we talk about living the paradox of enlightenment. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.